I want to thank Alan, first of all, for teaching on Sunday. If you all want to, we can just go ahead and have a vote right now, and maybe you all decide like to have him on a more permanent basis. The class was great. I got to hear it today, and really appreciate the work that he did in summing up the book and in talking about the role of Melchizedek. And so, kind of up to where we are, again, as Alan pointed out in the class, this is a continuous argument. It's difficult to break, and we need to follow the argument that the Hebrew writer is making. He pointed out that Jesus is a greater messenger with a greater message, and because he's a greater messenger with a greater message, we need to give greater attention to that message and not forsake that message. He is a greater servant, or greater than a servant. He is not a servant in God's house, but a son, and he is not a part of the house, but he is the builder of the house, and he is realizing a greater rest than the one that was promised. And so, again, we don't want to be like the children of Israel who died in the wilderness. And Alan did a really good job of pointing out that they're sort of the villain in the story. They're the epic failure, and their mistakes are not to be repeated, either by the Hebrew writer's audience or by us. And so we don't want to make the mistake that they did, and so we need to give heed to the one who offers us a better rest than Moses or Joshua could. And he's superior, a superior high priest, and so we need to give attention to that as well, and recognize that he's greater than the priests. He's greater in that he is without sin, and greater in the sense he's got a better sacrifice. One of the things that came up was in Alan's discussion, he kind of honed in on this, and I think it's worthy of our attention, is this statement in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 8, although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. And Alan talked a little bit about the idea of God learning is kind of a difficult concept for us, and because Jesus is God in the flesh, and Alan made the point that he experienced temptation in a way that was, I suppose, new. He's experiencing what we've experienced. And I really think that is the sense. There are a number of passages like this that I think it's somewhat helpful to look at to kind of get an idea, because they all seem to sort of emphasize the same kind of thing. And so in Luke 2, 51 and 52, I want to look at several of these passages and think about this just a little bit. Maybe this will be helpful to you. I told Alan just a minute ago I was going to give the same answer he did. Mine was just going to be longer and more convoluted. But hopefully thinking about this will be helpful. You remember when Luke records one event in Jesus' youth where he stays behind in the temple, and he is conversing with the teachers and both listening to them and asking them questions. And his parents are astonished, and they take him to task in Luke 2:48 and say, "Son, why have you treated us this way? Behold, your father and I have been anxiously looking for you." And he says to them, verse 49, "Why is it that you were looking for me? Did you not know that I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand the statement which he had made to them. And notice what it says then. He went down with them and came to Nazareth. And he continued in subjection to them. And his mother treasured all these things in his heart. And Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. And of course, that's one of those statements that sort of suggests the idea of Jesus learning or growing in some way. But it is in the context of a passage that is emphasizing the fact that right before that he said he continued in subjection to them. It's in the context of a passage that's emphasizing Jesus' subjection, yes, to his parents, but more importantly, to his Father's purpose. Okay? And it's also very much like another passage where it says Jesus kept increasing wisdom and stature and favor with God and men. That is almost a direct quote of 1 Samuel 2:26. And I want to go back and look at that because I think probably Luke is making an allusion back to 1 Samuel 2 and pointing out that there are some parallels between Jesus and Samuel. It's not the only parallel in Luke between Jesus and Samuel. Of course, Mary's song, the Magnificat, is very much like Hannah's song about her son. In 1 Samuel 2:26, it says, "Now the boy Samuel was growing in stature and in favor both with the Lord and with men." It's, again, an identical statement. But that statement, interestingly, comes on the heels of a passage about Eli's sons who were not obedient, who were not subjecting themselves to God or to their father. And Samuel has set forth as sort of a contrast to that. Now, with that in mind, let's look at Luke 22, 39 through 46, which is actually what the Hebrew writer is alluding to, not just Luke, but passages like this. In Luke 22, 39, it says, "He came out and proceeded, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples also followed him. And when he arrived at the place, he said to them, 'Pray that you may not enter into temptation.' And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and began to pray, saying, 'Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done.' Now an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him, and being in agony, he was praying very fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground. When he arose from his prayer, he came to his disciples and found them sleeping from sorrow. And he said to them, 'Why are you sleeping? Get up and pray that you may not enter into temptation.'" Now, clearly, prayer, the purpose of prayer in this passage is what? That you not enter into temptation. Yes, that was exactly the answer I was looking for. That you not enter into temptation. And Jesus prayed, and he subjugated his will to his Father's will, and he doesn't enter into temptation. And so this serves to reinforce the whole point of the Hebrew writer, that he was tempted in all points, even as we are, yet without sin. And so the idea of learning, it may be a bridge too far to say Jesus learned something he didn't know. I'm not sure that's the point. But the idea, as I understood Alan to say last time, is that he went through the same experience we go through in a way that he never would have enthroned in heaven in the midst of all the glory. He came down here and he entered into our experience. He took on flesh. He emptied himself of divine prerogatives in the sense that he doesn't use his divinity to get around any of these things. He engages his temptations and his sufferings in the same way that we have to, depending on his Father. He doesn't work miracles to feed himself, for instance. And so he goes through everything we've gone through. And he did that while obeying. And so that was his experience. And he went through that process. And in that sense, learned obedience through the things that he suffered. There was a temptation to avoid that. And it was an acute temptation. It would be wrong to think that Jesus wasn't tempted. It would be equally wrong to suggest that he succumbed to temptation. But he was genuinely tempted not to do what his Father wanted him to do, but he did it. He subjugated his will to that of his Father, and in that sense, he learned obedience from the things that he suffered. And in consequence, and the point the Hebrew writer's trying to drive home is, he can sympathize with us. But he sympathizes in a different way than the Levitical priests sympathize. The Levitical priests sympathize because they have engaged temptation and they've failed. And so they're not what they should be. Jesus is the perfect high priest, but at the same time, he's also perfectly sympathetic. And so he is what no one else could ever be. What no one else ever has been. What no one else ever will be. So, was that helpful at all? Or should I have just left you with what Alan said last time, which was exactly the same thing I said, just shorter and more elegant? Okay, never mind. It's probably best you don't answer that question. Let's move on. Back in Hebrews, five, 11, he started this. We covered this last time. I'm just going to touch on this very briefly. He takes them to task for becoming dull of hearing, for not growing like they should have. He warns them in 6:1-8 against falling away. And then he expresses in 6:9-12 encouragement by telling them that he is confident of better things concerning them, things concerning salvation. And he makes a statement here that we want to take note of in 6:11. He talks about the full assurance of hope. And he says, "We desire that each one of you show the same diligence so as to realize the full assurance of hope until the end." Now, hope, obviously, it should be obvious anyway. I say obviously, it should be obvious to us. Hope is a huge theme in the book of Hebrews. Now, why would hope be a huge theme in the book of Hebrews? Okay, they're being persecuted. And with persecution comes the temptation to what? Right. To turn away from what you believe in, to turn back. And I thought Alan made a great point last time that, you know, when we're in a crisis, we often default to what is most familiar. Okay, and so you know, that happens in all kinds of situations when they teach driving, or the same thing's true in motorcycling. And so you've got to develop good habits, because when something pulls out in front of you, you're going to do what you habitually do because you don't have time to think anymore. And that's what people do, is they fall back on what is most habituated. And there's a danger that these Jewish converts to Christianity will fall back to their Judaism in the midst of this crisis. They'll abandon their hope in Christ. And so hope comes up again and again and again and again and again. He talked about their hope in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 6. Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm until the end. In 6:19, in the text we're about to look at, he says, "This hope we have as an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil. In 7:19, he says, "For the law made nothing perfect, and on the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God." And again in 10:23, "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful." 10:23 is probably a pretty good practical summary of Hebrews. Hold fast our hope without wavering. And so this emphasis on hope is really, really being driven home. And so in 6:13 through 20, he brings up Abraham to talk about this hope, and to talk about the nature of this hope, and to encourage them to remain steadfast. And I want to touch on this before we dive back into Melchizedek. And so he talks about the promise that God made to Abraham, and he has a specific event in mind. Obviously, God makes this promise to Abraham again and again and again when he talks about blessing him and multiplying him. That is first made in Genesis chapter 12. But he picks this instance for a specific reason. Two specific reasons. One reason is on God's side of things. This is an occasion when God actually makes an oath. I don't know that's the only occasion, but it's stated to be an oath on this occasion. And it's also on Abraham's side of it, it is an occasion when Abraham demonstrated the kind of steadfast hope that the Hebrew writer is trying to instill in his audience. And so this event uniquely is useful for the Hebrew writer's point of all of the occasions he could have pointed to where God made this promise. And so let's go back for just a minute to Genesis 22, 15 through 17. And look at that. Before that, go on back to Genesis 17, 19 to 21, because there's something that's going to be really helpful to know as we're looking at this. In Genesis 17, God has said something that has great bearing on what happens in Genesis 22. In Genesis 17, 19, God says Abraham has asked that Ishmael might live before God. And God says, "No, but Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son." Isaac has not been born yet at this point. "And you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. As for Ishmael, I've heard you. Behold, I will bless him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall become the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you at this season next year." Now, in Genesis chapter 22... God asks Abram to do what with Isaac? Yeah, offer him as a sacrifice. Exactly so. So, this is not, I mean, it would be bad enough if the only thing at stake is Abraham's son Isaac. But who are the promises going to be fulfilled through? According to Genesis 17? Isaac. And so, how many children is Isaac likely to have after he dies? From a human perspective, from a human understanding. Okay. Yeah, very few. That's right. Very few. And so, the promises that God has made hang in the balance. Okay, we need to see this from Abraham's perspective. It's not only that he's been asked to kill his son, which would be difficult enough, but he's been asked to kill his son by the God who has promised that all of the promises he's made up to this point are going to be fulfilled through the son he's been asked to kill. Okay? Now, the Hebrew writer is going to reconcile all this for us. But, again, we need to see this from Abraham's perspective, or Abraham's perspective. And so Abraham does, in fact, take Isaac up on the mountain. He goes up the hill with fire in one hand, knife in the other, and Isaac carrying the wood. And he is about to take his son's life, and God stays his hand. And then the angel of the Lord calls to him a second time in Genesis 22:15, and says to him, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord." Okay, this is the passage, verse 16. This is the passage that the Hebrew writer quotes. "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemy. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." And so, the first thing that the Hebrew writer is going to hone in on is this idea that God swore by himself. And he's going to zoom in on that. When God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, "I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply you." And then, notice 15, "And so, having patiently waited, he obtained the promise." And so that's Abraham's side of it. We'll come back to that in a minute, having patiently waited. But first, in verse 16, he focuses in on the nature of an oath. And men, when they swear by one greater than themselves. And what would happen in Abraham's day, and in the Hebrew writer's day, is that men would call down the judgment of God upon themselves if they did not keep the promise they were making. And so it would happen something like this. Sometimes they would cut an animal in two and walk between the pieces, much the way God did Genesis 15. And they would say, "May this be done to me and worse also, if anything but death prevents me from keeping my promise." Or they would call down specific curses upon them. "May God do this to me, and this to me, and this to me." And that was in fact done in the renewal of the covenant, that there are certain curses that are specified in the book of Deuteronomy that are a part of not the consequences of unfaithfulness, but curses that the people called down upon themselves if they were unfaithful. And those were in addition to the consequences of unfaithfulness that are enumerated in Deuteronomy 28. And so this was a necessary part. And men call somebody greater into the picture because, well, why? Why does an oath only become substantive when men call somebody greater in to enforce it? What is it about the nature of men that makes that necessary? They're untrustworthy. That's exactly right. Men cannot be counted on to tell the truth, and so that's what makes oaths, in fact, necessary. Obviously, Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says they shouldn't be necessary in the kingdom because you should be trustworthy. But the fact is that men weren't trustworthy, and so an oath is given as a confirmation, and it is the end of every dispute. In the same way, God desiring even more to show the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of His purpose, interposed with an oath. So that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us. And so the two unchangeable things, as I understand this, are the oath and the nature of God. God is not like man. God does not need an oath. But so that Abraham would have full confidence in the promise that God is making, he interposed with an oath to give even greater assurance. Now, the fact that it is in God's nature is such that he cannot lie should have been enough, but he adds the oath to it. And so the nature of oaths and the nature of God are both a testimony to the fact that this is sure and true. Now, the Hebrew writer is going to come back around much later, chapter 11, and tell us that what Abraham was thinking when all this unfolded. And that what he was thinking was that God was able even to raise Isaac from the dead, which he does in a figure by staying Abraham's hand and not allowing him to kill Isaac. But that is yet to come. He's going to come back around to that. The Hebrew, he does this continuously. He'll introduce something and then he'll come back around to it and sew it up tight. But this whole thing really is very, very tightly woven. We can trust in our hope. Our hope can be carried out with confidence. And understand, hope is something, from the Hebrew writer's perspective, hope is something that needs to be carried out. It's not a thought or a feeling, but it is a course of action that is determined by confidence in the promises of God. And the nature of God is such that we can do what Abraham did and act confidently on the promises God has made. And he says, this hope we have as an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one that enters within the veil where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And so our hope of being reconciled to God is based on the fact that Jesus has entered into the presence of God as this Melchizedek-like high priest. He's entered into the presence of God. The entering in is a very different kind of entering in, though, if you think about, when did the Levitical priests go into the Holy of Holies? The Day of Atonement, Leviticus 16. They entered in on the Day of Atonement. They went in carrying a censer, and the Hebrew writer is going to allude to this later on, carrying a censer that was smoking, so it's sort of a moving barrier between them and God. And they would sprinkle the blood on the altar. But then they came back out. And then they came back out because they're going to have to go back in and come back out. And go back in and come back out. And go back in and come back out. And go back in and come back out. Just add a whole bunch more of those. And why do they have to keep going back in and coming back out? Again, he's going to sew this up later, but I want to touch on it now. because their work's not done. Because the problem of sin isn't solved. Jesus went into the Holy of Holies and did what? He stayed. Why is it He can stay? Well, one reason is His work's done. It's a completed work. It's a finished work. And so He is our anchor that is steadfast. He is our anchor to God. And the fact that He has gone in and stayed is a clear indication that we have a sure and steadfast hope. And if we, you know, again, he's kind of alluding to something that he just kind of touches on it, and he's going to come back to it later on. But they're thinking about going back to the Old Testament and doing things the Old Testament way, and he says, look, you know, the Old Testament way would be to do it like Abraham did. And if you do it like Abraham did, you won't abandon your hope, because Abraham didn't abandon his hope. It's very similar to what Jesus says to the Jews, who said, we have Abraham as our father. And he said, no, because you don't do what Abraham did. Abraham is not your father. Because if Abraham was your father, you would do what Abraham did. You would trust God, and you don't. So clearly he's not. And the Hebrew writer is, again, he's just giving it a touch and moving on. But he does give it a touch. Any thoughts or questions, comments about Hebrews 6, 13 through 20? Okay. So that's kind of the closing argument. But notice he says, having become a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, he's brought that up several times. He brought it up back in 5:10, and he left it to kind of give them this exhortation. He's brought it up several times. But now, in chapter 7, it's as if he's kind of assumed they know something about Melchizedek. But now he really begins to unpack it. And I'm not going to try and redo everything Alan did, but I am going to give you a follow-up quiz. Who is Melchizedek? King of Salem, which is translated King of Peace. That's right, and it probably was Jerusalem. The Salem, Shalom, Peace. But King of Salem, that is King of Peace. And what else? What else do we know about Melchizedek? It's in terms of his role, what else was he in terms of his role? Priest of whom? The Most High God. He is King of Salem and priest of the Most High God. And where do we meet King of Salem, priest of the Most High God? I'm not looking for a specific geographical location. You don't have to give me GPS coordinates or anything. I just want to know what's going on. Where has Abraham been? And what's he been doing? Okay, in 2018, the morning Bible reading is going to be read through the Old Testament twice, and that's going to be a good thing. Okay, so you remember that there wasn't room for Abram's flocks and Lot's flocks, and so Lot went down and lived where? Sodom, in the Valley of the Jordan, near Sodom. And there was a coalition of kings under a fellow named Cardo Laomer, which is an underutilized biblical name if you've got children or grandchildren. Cardo Laomer and these other guys come down and they attack the king of Sodom and his coalition, and they defeat them thoroughly. And they carry off Lot, and so Abraham grabs a couple of neighbors and their guys, and they pursue them. These are, I guess, his neighbors happen to be powerful tribal princes or something, but they pursue them, and they rout this coalition under Cardo Laomer, and they bring everything back, Lot included. And when they are coming back in Genesis 14, they are met by two kings. One of them is the king of Sodom, and one of them is the king of Salem, who is also priest of the Most High God, Melchizedek. And when two things happen that are significant, Melchizedek does a couple of things. And there are many things about that text that are interesting. There are some things that aren't said that are really important, and there are some things that are said that are really important. One thing the Hebrew writer doesn't touch on, but I think it's significant in seeing just how important Melchizedek is the contrast between how Abram interacts with the king of Sodom and how he interacts with the king of Salem, Melchizedek. Because the king of Sodom comes out and he says, "Give me the people, you can have all the spoils." And Abram says, "No, I'm not doing it. I'm not having you go around saying you made me rich." And he's almost dismissive of the king of Sodom. There doesn't seem to be a great deal of respect there. And I only bring that up because it is a stark contrast to his interaction with Melchizedek. Now, what two things happen with regard to Abraham and Melchizedek? What does Melchizedek do for Abraham? He blesses him, and what does Abraham do with regard to Melchizedek? He pays tithes, right? Abraham pays tithes to Melchizedek in Genesis 14:20, and Melchizedek blesses Abraham in Genesis 14:19. And so he is going to make some important points about this. Of course, it's significant that Melchizedek is both king and priest. We should already be thinking along the lines of the 110th Psalm. But there are some things I want to bore down on a little bit here with regard to Melchizedek, and I want us to think about this. The Hebrew writer makes the point that Melchizedek is without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he remains a priest perpetually. Now, is the Hebrew writer's point that Melchizedek literally, actually didn't have any parents and any descendants, and he's a perpetual priest? No. No. Huh? Okay. I will. Notice this statement. He says, made like the Son of God. Okay? This is an analogy based on silence. Melchizedek just sort of drops in on us. We don't, outside of Genesis 14, what other narrative information do we have about Melchizedek in the Old Testament? Exactly so. You all answered that correctly. We don't know anything. And so this is an argument from silence. We don't know anything about his... The only thing we know about Melchizedek is God made him a priest. We don't know anything about the beginning of his priesthood. We don't know anything about the end of his priesthood. And so, and he is both priest and king. And because of those things, he is the perfect type of Christ. But if he really never had any parents, and he really is a never-ending priest, then he wouldn't be like Jesus. He would be Jesus. And some people think he is. But that's not what the Hebrew writer says. The Hebrew writer is making an analogy. Okay? He's analogous to, and I think by design, I think this was on God's part anyway, premeditated. But obviously it was because of the 110th Psalm. So he makes this point that in so many ways he anticipates God's ideal. And then, as Alan pointed out last time, again, I won't go into all this. Obviously, this man is greater than Abraham. And Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. Why? Why does he say in verse 4 and following, why does he say Melchizedek is necessarily greater than Abraham? What did Abraham do? He paid tithes to him. Okay? And so the point is that this priest-king, Melchizedek, who is only a type, who is only analogous to Jesus, he anticipates Jesus. The type is greater than Abraham. If the type is greater than Abraham, the reality is far greater than Abraham. Okay? So think about this. The picture of Jesus is greater than Abraham. So if the picture of Jesus is greater than Abraham, how much greater is Jesus than Abraham? Obviously a lot. And that is the argument that the Hebrew writer is making. Now, he goes on to point out that where were the sons of Levi, the Levitical priests, where were they when Abraham paid tithes? They weren't there yet, but from the Hebrew writer's standpoint, they are there, in a sense. And in what sense are they there? They're in Abraham's loins. I mean, they're in his seed. They are going to be his offspring. And so Alan made the point, I think, very well last time, that what's greater, the Father or the Son? The Father is greater than the Son. So if the Father paid tithes to Melchizedek, Melchizedek is necessarily greater than the Father, then he's that much greater again than the sons. Okay? So here's where Jesus stands. All right? The picture, the type of Jesus is greater than Abraham, who is greater than Levi. And so the picture or type of Jesus is far greater than Levi. The reality... Okay, so do you see we have several orders of magnitude greater than? It's not Jesus is a little better high priest. This is an involved progression upward here from where the Levites are in the loins of Abraham, who is not as great as the guy who is the picture of what the reality Jesus will later be. And so it's not like you got the Levites here and Jesus here. That's not, okay? The Levites are here and Jesus is not on the page anywhere. He's off, literally off the charts, better than the Levites. And that's the picture that the Hebrew writer wants us to see. Thank you. We'll press on next time.